Like, I just want to talk about the Oscars. This episode is going to come out about 5.5 hours. I'm assuming it'll run long after the Oscars ends on Sunday. And this will come out at 5 a.m. on Monday. So last year, kind of called shot, I Babe Ruth pointed to the stands and we queued up an Everything Everywhere All at Once episode to come out a few hours after the Oscars named it Best Picture. I'm kind of thinking the same thing is going to happen. So that's why we're doing an Oppenheimer episode. So if I'm wrong about that, then joke's on me, but let's talk about Oppie anyway.
Oh man, that sounds good. I kind of want to talk about Oscars too, especially I just finished Past Lives and Dune 2.
For sure. There's a lot to talk about. I kind of also just want to talk about Oscars, but it's fine. Let's start the episode so we can just do that. As you know, I don't know how to start the episode, so it'll either be, I guess that's all keepable for once since Craig joined. Pretty much it's all keepable. I don't know if that's ever happened. Or something along the lines of Welcome to Late to the Movies. My name is Ben Holt. This is a podcast where my friends and I get to fill in our movie blind spots. Each week we'll pick a film that either I or a guest hadn't seen before and really should have by now. That still applies this month, even though the hadn't seen before is because all of these movies have come out in the last 12 months. This one coming out in July, you and I saw it together opening weekend, so it's actually been a little bit, but still counts. These movies are, generally speaking, new, all Best Picture nominees this month. This one, which may or may not have won Best Picture just a few hours ago, is Oppenheimer, Christopher Nolan's biopic about the guy in the title, J. Robert Oppenheimer. Before we get to all that, your guest, this Left Right Crosser podcast, we got Robbie.
Hey.
Hey, Craig's here too. On the, I don't know, on the levels, on the sound speeds. He's doing what he does. He's a robot bear, and he always looks terrified. And he doesn't ever speak. But anyway, Robbie, how's it going? How's your walk with Oscars going this season?
Pretty good. I think I'm down to just 3 left. I got Anatomy of a Fall, which I've seen 10 minutes of, Maestro, and Poor Things.
So it was funny because I only watched Anatomy of a Fall yesterday as we're recording this. But I remember a little while ago you mentioning in the Discord, like, yeah, I was just listening in the right headspace. There's like a looping noise that plays in the first 10 minutes. There's just like, this isn't time for me. And then I was like, I wonder what that is. And then watching it, it's like, I wonder if that was the noise. And there's like a couple noises happening. And then extremely loudly, an instrumental version of 50 Cent's PIMP starts playing on loop. And I'm like, oh, this probably was what he was talking about.
It's just like, it's so loud and I'm having to pay attention. And like, I honestly, it just made me like nuts, like literally nuts. And then I wanted to see if anybody else online was complaining about it without finding spoilers. And the only thing I came across was like, Anatomy of a Fall is a chaotic thriller. And I was like, oh, they're trying to disorient you. Like, that was intentional. Okay. So, like, I'm ready to go back into it and watch it now, but, like, at least I have an explanation.
Yeah, that scene wraps up pretty quickly, and then it doesn't play, like, the whole movie or anything, but they do go back to it a couple times. It turns into a procedural, sort of, but, like, a fresh take on a procedural, and it's about this wife who's on trial for the murder of her husband, who maybe fell out of a window high up in their chalet in France, or maybe was pushed out, or maybe jumped out. And it happened while this music was playing super loudly on loop. So like in the reenactments, they have to play it also, which is funny.
When I saw that it was a procedural, that's pretty much what I assumed, because I got to the point where the husband's like dead on the ground. And,
there you go.
My first thought is just like, this bitch definitely killed him. Like the way she was answering those questions in the first 10 minutes, just like her whole demeanor. I was like, I don't know. So I'm excited to see, because obviously it's not going to be that cut and dry or else it wouldn't be much of a movie. But I'm excited to see how they play all that.
The French media definitely agrees with your initial take during, like, in, you know, in the background, and the prosecutor's an asshole, but I just like, and I guess this is my, what have I watched recently? I watched Anatomy of a Fall yesterday. I liked it a lot. I like procedurals anyway. So procedurals are like, you know, courtroom dramas where it's about, you know, the person on trial defending themselves or the lawyer figuring out the case, figuring out a defense, the prosecution doing what they do. In this movie, it's the fresh take I mentioned before is sort of, it's all very subjective. It's all very show, don't tell. And you as the audience have to kind of make up your own mind about like, okay, what if this is real? What is, what actually happened? What else have you been watching? You've been, I mean, it's Oscar season. You've watched certainly other things since the last time you've been on, I assume.
Oh yeah. So, I mean, I've watched, Zone of Interest. I watched, Dune 2. I watched, what was the most recent one? I think it was Zone of Interest and then just, Past Lives Right Now. I watched, half of Aquaman 2 while I was taking a nap the other day. It's real bad.
Jeez.
Yeah. I mean, it's fine. I just wanted to put on something for background noise that I didn't care if I missed some of it. So that was good.
Yeah, that's probably the way that WB intended you to watch that. I don't know. I'm sure it's fun, but like, it's not something I'm like champing at the bit to throw on my TV and commit some hours to.
I would like to read a book about it because I really like what they're doing with like the Atlantean lore and stuff like that. I find that stuff really interesting, but it's just, it's not a good movie.
I might be wrong on this, but I have to assume these are adapted from some sort of books, right?
I think it's probably comics, and I've never really been able to like read comics.
I've never gotten into it either. We have some friends who have, but it's never been my thing for sure. But yeah, I'm sure it definitely in the first movie, even there's like so much lore that just sort of gets scratched at and they don't really go into, but
they're doing like some kind of global warming, alternate fuel source kind of thing. I don't know. I don't know exactly where they were. There's too many threads they were pulling at all at the same time. I also didn't finish it. So that could be part of the.
Yeah, I guess in its defense, but like, you know, at a certain point, the movie has to demand you. Yeah, exactly. The movie has to demand you finish it itself. That's on it.
If you can get an hour into something and be like, then it's just not a good movie.
The juice ain't worth the squeeze.
Oh, but outside of that, I mean, I also watched Killers of the Flower Moon, which is probably one of my favorites. But to Greg's point about not being able to remember anything from it, I do kind of feel that because I can't remember a ton about it. Just that, like, we were really shitty to the indigenous people.
I'm the wrong person to give perspective on that because I just watched it yesterday. So I remember it pretty well. I would be surprised if it doesn't really stick with me. It was kind of like, I don't know, colossal to me and sort of blew me away. But, you know, I just watched it less than 24 hours ago, so maybe I'll feel differently by Sunday. I'll let you know.
I felt the same way. And I think the feelings I got from it will stick with me. I think the like, wow, this really changed my whole perspective on like what the native life was like before we completely and totally fucked them over. That was like, you know, part of the way through us fucking them over. But I think I might've said this in the chat. I didn't have a good picture of like what it would look like to have, you know, the cowboys living with the indigenous peoples. Like, I assumed they were more separate. I didn't picture them like in town together. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think that was really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, the like watching it and being like, this is only 100 years ago. The guy that Leo plays died in 1986. Like,
right.
It's, you know, and he was 94. He wasn't like super notably old at the time.
Very recent. Did you see the little blurb I shared from Wikipedia about his son? Fantastic.
Yeah, he made the right call.
Hey, what's up, guys?
Yeah, we knew it.
We talked about this. It's going to make the episode look so cool.
Are you three playing Baldur's Gate without me, or what's going on here?
Yeah, us and Craig, we're playing BG3.
Oh, sick.
Craig's real bad.
I figured he's bad.
You can actually participate. We only just started, so we're doing what we watched recently, and we're just talking about Oscar movies. So,
oh, you got? I'm in. What did
we just got to Killers of the Flower Moon. Robbie was saying that he kind of agrees that it hasn't stuck with him the way he thought it would.
Yeah, you know, I have the same feeling on that one because I watching it, and the next day I was like, oh, this is fire. I really liked it. And then a couple weeks later, I was like, okay, I have this, it just gone.
Yeah, it's interesting. I just watched it yesterday, so I don't have that perspective on it, you know.
I think Noah probably heard it from me, is I think one of the things that stick with it so much is the, like, the whole, like, atrocity of the whole thing, that this is something we did to people, you know what I mean? But then,
like, literally what I just said.
The next week, I watched Zone of Interest.
Oh, sure.
And that was a little worse. This is worse. You know what I mean?
It's much more in your face about genocide.
Yes. And
it's a lot more implicating the viewer, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. It's a lot more like, you, this happened and people did nothing. Not that Killers of the Flower Moon didn't do that, well, especially when it's a little, like, its ending kind of emphasized that, like, nothing bad really happened for the most part. But yeah, so that maybe that's why that one fell off for me. I'm not sure though.
Yeah, I loved it, but like I said, less than 24 hours ago for me, so it's still with me. Yeah. I should mention that's Greg that just joined for the listeners.
they can see.
it's interesting because Zone of Interest was like, this happened and nobody did anything, and Killers of the Flower Moon is, this happened and nobody even knows about it. So just very different.
Well, if you wait in like 10 years or so, they'll they can do Zone of Interest again. It'll be like, this happened and everyone insisted didn't.
Oh no.
10? That's optimistic.
Yeah.
Right?
It's an election year.
Oh god.
Ten months maybe.
Did you mention Poor Things, Ben?
Oh, we haven't gotten there yet.
Oh, right.
I haven't seen it yet, so can't do too many spoilers.
I don't know. Have we mentioned this? People have definitely talked about Poor Things on the podcast, right?
Yeah, a lot of people have at least said they watched it. This is the first one I'm recording since I watched it, so I usually go, no spoilers. And then someone's like, it was weird. And I was like, damn you.
Yeah, what do you think, Ben?
Spoiled.
Oh, it
without
was weird.
Spoiling anything for Robbie.
Yeah, it was weird. Sorry, Robbie.
That's fine.
I liked it a lot.
I'd say watch Poor Things next. It's very much worth a watch. It's not one I would have wanted to miss.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that's fair. For like our interests and the stuff that we'll want to talk about with each other, I would say Poor Things.
Fair.
Anyway, let's talk about Oppenheimer.
All right, Hoppy.
I'm trying to get you out of here soon because I want you to go watch Poor Things. Oppenheimer, I saw opening weekend. I think we went to the IMAX in Providence. It was completely sold out. It wasn't completely full though, because Corey didn't go, so we had an empty seat next to us. This was the time that they made us wait like 30 minutes, because that was one of the 19 screens in North America in which they were showing it on 70mm IMAX, and the projector wasn't cooperating, so it started about 35 minutes late. And knowing that it was an over 3 hour long movie, that was kind of frustrating in the moment, but I don't feel it now. I'm glad that we stayed.
For sure. Quick side note, Dune, they didn't have the ACs on yet, on like what is probably a hottest day in March we've ever experienced.
It's just like a 4D movie. It's like the chairs were probably moving and they made it really hot because you're on Arrakis, right?
I was like, I sweat through my shirt onto my chair, and I think Derek was don't waste your water on the desert. But yeah. Anyways, Oppenheimer.
God. Oh, yeah, we didn't even get to talk. By the next episode you're on, I will have also seen Dune 2. I was supposed to go with you also to the same IMAX theater to see Dune 2, and I was sick over the weekend. You can probably tell my voice is still not great. And it hasn't been since January, so this is just what the podcast sounds like now. Sorry. So we went to see it at the same time. So, you know, we're tied. Either of us eligible to do a 1 minute plot summary. If you feel like you have one, I feel like you can go really short or really complicated with the plot summary for this movie.
I think I can do that.
All right.
So, we got Oppenheimer, story of how the nuclear bomb was made. Done. No, just kidding. So it's Oppenheimer's going into a little bit of detail about like the difficulties of the rise of Russia right after World War II, and you know, some kind of McCarthyism. So they're really doing like a flashback, flash forward thing, which is about, you know, a Senate confirmation hearing that is kind of going seemingly well. about this guy that really had a target on the back of Oppenheimer. So it's a really interesting story of him getting the bomb built, how they set up the Manhattan Project, how they ended up in the middle of New Mexico, and really what the goal was of the bomb. Not necessarily just to kill people, not necessarily just to end the war, but they really saw it as something that would end all wars. So they really go through Oppenheimer building it. They go through the targeting of him in the hearings, and it wraps up really nicely with the same kind of smear campaign that was used to discredit Oppenheimer is what ends up with the senator not getting confirmed into a cabinet position. That was kind of all over the place. I don't know if you want to delete that and do a different one, but...
No, I mean, this movie is nonlinear, so all over the place, I think, fits for a plot summary as well. Did someone say nonlinear? This is our first Christopher Nolan movie. One of my favorite directors, and someone I haven't gotten a chance to talk about on the podcast before, aside from, I'm sure, when we went to see this movie, whatever the next episode was, we talked about, hey, here's what I've watched recently. But yeah, I like Chris Nolan a lot. He loves time. The structure of this movie is interesting. There's the... I wouldn't know the actual years if I wasn't like looking at this, but it's Oppenheimer giving a subjective account of his life. That part's in color. That's the fission part. And then the other part in black and white is fusion. And that's Louis Strauss, played by Robert Downey Jr. That's him in the 1959 Senate confirmation hearing. And that's in black and white. And so the objective is black and white. The subjective is in color. It's bouncing, bouncing, bouncing back and forth. And yeah, I don't know. So I guess there's a lot of questions, because I think going plot beat by plot beat, we would get really frustrated and give up after about 20 minutes of trying that. So instead, I just kind of put together a bunch of questions that we can kind of talk about. And if they're not good, I'll just edit them out of the episode. But what's your overall, how do you feel about the structure of this thing? Structure is always such a big part of the way Chris Nolan puts together his movies. And I don't know if it's ever been quite so rigid is maybe the wrong word, but like this part's in black and white and is this guy's point of view. This part's in color and is this guy's point of view. I mean, he did that in Memento. That was over 20 years ago now, but it's, you know, it's a very prominent structural conceit. I don't know. How do you feel about it?
I like it. I've been thinking about that a lot, and I think it was absolutely necessary to do it that way. Because what happens is you're in a movie, and with anything like this, you're expecting there to be a villain. And I think he wanted the audience to like kind of be uncertain on Oppenheimer, but that he couldn't just come out right and say that Strauss is the villain, because then you wouldn't really have that uncertainty. So it tied together nicely where it's like the villain here is really society at large. It's McCarthyism, and that's represented by Strauss.
Yeah. It's good. I think an easy place to get into this movie is the performances, not just Cillian Murphy, who I think is awesome as Oppenheimer and gives a very, you know, it's sometimes seen as like cynically like, oh, here's how you get Oscar's attention is, you know, do a biopic and be the main character. But Cillian Murphy's a guy that I've loved for a long time as an actor. He hasn't been the lead of a lot of movies that have made as much money as this one did in America. And then you also have someone like Robert Downey Jr. in the supporting role as Strauss, and he's awesome. And then, I don't know, like 50 best actor winners are just sort of in a scene or two around the edges of this thing. It's kind of crazy. What are your favorite performances in this?
I think probably Cillian Murphy. I also just really love him. I watched Peaky Blinders and he was just fantastic in that. So I'm just really happy to see him do more stuff, do big screen stuff. I also just like him as a person. Everything I read about like how he behaves and like when he's in a movie, he's really boring to be around because he's just so consumed with what he's doing. And you can see that in his acting. And like, it's just really cool to see somebody that dedicated, but not like in a method actor way, just in a like, let me put my head down and get my work done kind of way. Yeah. Which I think is great. And then Robert Downey Jr., of course, is probably, you know, close number two. But also, gotta give a shout out to the, I don't know if I can phrase it like this, but the Jewish assistant guy, what was his name? He was the one like on the train with him that was telling him to eat and stuff like that.
David Krumholz is the actor, and he's awesome. And we've done him before too. Were you on the 10 Things I Hate About You episode? I might have just been.
I was.
Yeah.
Who was he in that?
He's Joseph Gordon-Levitt's friend that keeps quoting Shakespeare.
Oh my God.
He put on some weight for this role, and you know, about 25 years of age as well, but still.
Definitely. Unrecognizable. But I thought he was really good. I liked him being like kind of the moral compass conscious kind of person.
Yeah, he's great. He kills the scenes that he's in. Haven't mentioned, you know, Matt freaking Damon is also. It's great. He comes on the screen, I don't know, 45 minutes, an hour in, and you're like, oh, it becomes like sort of a they establish like a buddy cop dynamic about, you know, making bombs or whatever. And by the time he leaves the film, that's when the main character, Oppenheimer, gets like completely emotionally unmoored, because after the Trinity test, all of this shit's taken away from him and out of his control. And Matt Damon pretty much exits the movie, and you're like, oh, that I didn't realize that that guy had been my security blanket, and I just loved having him around.
But he was like very like a reality check kind of person. He was super neutral in everything. I also love the scene where like Oppenheimer looks into his background and is like, all right, just so we're on the same page, like, I know you're very intelligent, and I also know exactly why you picked me. Like, very cool, because he does not come across like, he does a good job of acting like somebody who isn't like super intelligent until you get to know him a little better, and you're like, oh, okay, this person just doesn't feel the need to show off at all.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Cause he looks into him. He's like, oh, you actually like know about this shit.
Yeah. Like, I think
you have the capacity to do it. And
stuff. Like, you're not just a military general that's overseas. Like, you went to MIT. Like,
right.
You might not be able to do this stuff, but you could. Like, Oppenheimer wouldn't have been able to be a double agent that was like secretly fucking things up, because that would have been obvious to someone that at least has a glancing knowledge of what's going on.
A couple other very prominent actors in this movie, that have been among the most talked about parts of, I guess, in the discourse. It's hard to remember now. It's been like 10 months, but, not quite 10, whatever. It was since last summer. Chris Nolan quite often, gets called out for not being able to write women and for having characters whose wives die. So Emily Blunt, who doesn't die in this movie, Florence Pugh, who does, have been some of the most talked about parts of this movie. Two actors that I love. Emily Blunt got a supporting actress nomination at the Oscars this year. I don't feel like she has a lot to do in this movie, but I do like Florence Pugh in this movie.
I would have given it to Florence Pugh over Emily Blunt.
She just kind of has more to do, just on like a basic level. Maybe Emily Blunt's in more scenes and she does get to give a mean look to Benny Safdie towards the end, but that's pretty much kind of it.
That was one of my favorite parts of the movie, where she just like absolutely refuses to shake his hand. Like, yeah, I know, good. You son of a bitch. Like,
it's a good payoff.
It was good. Was that her just an old person makeup?
Yeah.
It was pretty good.
Yeah, and I think Murphy plays Oppenheimer from when he's in his early 20s at school, and they just give him like looser hair until that scene where he's, I guess, in his 70s or whatever. But it's always Cillian Murphy too.
That's good. I think he was a little bit easier because he's right in that like middle age where even without makeup, you could be like, is he 30? Is he 50? I don't know.
Right. Right. Josh Hartnett is the professor at UC Berkeley who is kind of, I don't know, like the normal brainy guy that's trying to help Oppenheimer not get in trouble with the FBI.
Yes, very well played. Like, I love the line he walked of like, I'm just trying to keep you out of trouble, you dumbass. Like, I don't really care about the views one way or the other, but like, you need to keep your mouth shut.
Yeah. Like, this is I'm not trying to be a dick. It's clear you don't understand the peril that you are constantly in with the stuff that you do.
I love that, like, you're not just self-important, you're actually important, was just a banger of a line.
Yeah. I saw some people say that line was dumb, and I disagreed with them. I like that line. It's good.
He was both. Like, that was a good line. I don't understand why you wouldn't.
Exactly. It's true. I don't want to just list everyone that's in this dumb movie, but, like, we haven't even mentioned Best Actor winner. Yeah. To say best, Josh Peck, Best Actor winner Rami Malek is in two scenes and very important ones. Best Actor winner Gary Oldman is in one scene and is really good in that scene.
What scene is that?
He's Truman.
Oh, okay.
It's just good.
It was good because I just fucking hated that guy so much. I was like, oh, you're like one of the worst people in this movie.
A different flavor, but the same takeaway. Casey Affleck jump scare in one part of the movie where he shows up and like very quietly affirms like, oh, this guy is the worst man on the planet. He's the guy that's sort of been like following Oppenheimer, the one that Matt Damon gets freaked out that he talked to.
Oh, right.
And then you see like the one scene that he's actually in when he's interrogating Oppenheimer. And the interrogation, like, his voice barely ever rises above a whisper, but you're just like, oh, that guy knows like 10 different ways to kill someone with his hands and is constantly evaluating what's the best option in any given moment. You just get that impression.
It was probably intentional, but my thought is like, if you put that character in a different uniform, he could just very easily be playing an SS officer.
Yep.
Just like similar attitudes, similar like, oh, you're both just as fanatical, like, and you're both willing to do absolutely horrible things in pursuit of whatever goal you've decided is worthy of your pursuits.
Yeah. Over in the Robert Downey timeline, Alden Ehrenreich, he got out of movie prison for Solo, I guess, and he's really good in this. He's the younger aide that is trying to help him get confirmed, but by the end of the movie he's kind of like, I don't like you, you're an asshole.
So I couldn't tell if he knew the whole time. I was thinking that like he was the one that like was leaking this stuff, or he was, I know right towards the end he very intentionally, like, that question of like maybe they were talking about something more important was 100% designed to send him spiraling. Like, that was such a psychological mind fuck. I was like, that's beautiful.
Yeah, that's the part of the movie that gets very, I mean, I use the term procedural to describe Anatomy of a Fall and saying that was a fresh take on the procedural. That bit of the movie, the last like 45 minutes, gets very like tropey, procedural, very grounded after a very experimental like first hour and change of this movie, Oppenheimer, that some people have bounced off of. A lot of people say it's very Aaron Sorkin-y, especially with lines like that. But that stuff always works for me, so I'm fine with it. But I can see why that shift rubs some people the wrong way. Not to get too much into the plot, but I think that was just about all the people that I wanted to specifically call out. And I was hoping by doing so, we would cover a lot of the plot anyway and not have to go back and cover anything. But should mention, I asked you about structure before. I really do like the conceit of returning to that Einstein moment throughout. And just seeing not really what happened and just having Strauss's takeaway that guy messed up my chance to be friends with Einstein. And so I'm going to go on a decade long vendetta against him, and it building up to, well, he didn't actually even talk about you. Alden Ehrenreich was right. They were talking about something more important. It was Oppenheimer saying stuff that bummed Einstein out so much that he was like catatonic when Strauss tried to say hi to him a few seconds later.
Like, oh yeah, people are using my work to potentially end all life on Earth. This is great.
Yeah. And not to skip ahead too far, but I'm not really sure how the structure of this episode's even going to be, so that's fine. What'd you make of the ending? Because you do finally see what Oppenheimer and Einstein talk about next to the pond after Einstein's hat blows away. That guy, you get like a chin strap. His hat's blowing off every like 20 minutes in this movie.
Well, that's his thing. Everybody knows Einstein, his hat blew off, and then he discovered the force of wind.
That's why his hair looks like that in those pictures.
No, I really, really liked it. I loved how they tied it all together. I like the concept of like, they don't really talk shit on Einstein, but he's kind of mocked a little bit of like, yeah, he discovered this stuff. He never really embraced it. Like, he doesn't care about the quantum realm. And then like, you see the parallel through with Oppenheimer, like he discovered the atom bomb, but he doesn't embrace the hydrogen bomb. And you almost wonder, like, is that why, like, did Einstein really not like the quantum realm, or was he like at the realization of, ah, fuck, I went too far. So yeah. I like that. I really like the, like, they're gonna shit on you. And then, you know, sometime later, they'll finally give you an award.
Yeah.
It's not gonna be for them, for you. It's 100% for them. And like, that's a really insightful, and like, he just dealt with it. I'd love to know how much of that is based in reality and how much of that was like artistic license, but I really liked that message, yeah, or that motif.
It's so good. And then the last moments of the movie, as it's just like, you know, Cillian Murphy staring directly into the camera, intercut with just Armageddon imagery. Yeah, I don't know. You don't walk away with it with a happy, warm feeling, but I thought it was pretty effective.
Yeah, and it's like, I don't know. How naive do you have to be to think that like any invention would end all war? Like, it's not going to, I mean, unless the invention is like infinite resources for everyone, it's not going to end all war. Although Star Trek even did a good bit on that. They were like, I guess I've only seen this through memes, but they went to like a planet that was basically, you know, future Earth in like 100 years. And they were like, well, why don't we just give them replicators and they'll have food? And they were like, well, if we give them replicators now, the wealthy few are just going to hoard them and it'll just be another source of income inequality. So it's like, there's really like, until society is ready to change, there's no invention that will change society.
Oof, that's fair. So that brings us to like one of the good, you know, thinky questions. Strauss's argument isn't that Oppenheimer's necessarily like wrong or anything. His big sticking point is like when he could put his name on it and become a national hero and like a brand onto himself, he was very gung-ho about making this thing. And then once it was like not taken away from him, he was like, oh no, actually this is bad. And that's obviously a simplistic and very embittered way to look at it through Strauss's eyes. But I'm curious, do you think, you know, you mentioned like it's really naive that he thought this was the thing to end all wars. I guess, is your takeaway either from real life or from the movie, is this like a tragedy? Did Oppenheimer kind of know what he was doing? Does that not matter? And is this all his fault anyway? And then like, also, what do you think that the movie is trying to argue? Cause I'm not sure it actually really fully answers whether or not it has that much sympathy for Oppenheimer in the end.
So, I mean, somebody being attributed to a quote from the Bhagavad Gita of "I am become death, the destroyer of worlds," is not the quote of somebody that's actually understands what he did. That's definitely like a pompous asshole thing to say, in my opinion. Like,
especially to say it while you're having sex with Florence Pugh. Like he was in his zone, you know, he was feeling himself.
I don't know exactly if that's where it came up, but that feels like artistic license, but like that feels like something you would say as like, oh shit, people are on to me. You know, it's just not very self-reflective, and it's like stealing from others' work. Like you could have said something more. I don't know. It's interesting. Do you know where that like where that quote comes from? Like in like what the context of that quote is?
Apparently, he did say it after the Trinity tests.
Oh, I mean it in the Hindu text.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. In the Bhagavad Gita. And in the context, I'm vaguely aware of it.
So a prince is at war, and he decides to, like, the common people are revolting, and he decides to leave his friends that are in their royalty and join them. And he calls forth Shiva, who goes out and just decimates the battlefield and just murders all of his friends. And then right after that, that's the I Am Become Death, Destroyer of Worlds. So it's a very poignant quote, but, like, I don't know. He didn't destroy his friends. He destroyed some random people in fucking Japan. So I don't really feel like he felt the full weight of it. You know what I mean?
Yes. And that definitely sounds like something that you know, workshop and, like, rehearse and prepare to say, right? But I also like that the movie sort of makes it seem like this is just a kind of weird dude who does say shit like that genuinely.
That's fair, because I'm kind of a weird dude that says stuff like that. I just gave you the text of the fuck out of me. Right.
And then like later on when he meets Truman and says he feels like he has blood on his hands, that is actually a thing that he said. And in turn, Truman actually did say, like, don't let that crybaby back in here.
Yeah. And I think it's just because he's disingenuous about it. Like,
yeah.
That just seems like something you'd say when you want somebody to be like, no, you're a good little boy. It's okay. And it's like, no, you're not. You do have blood on your hands. You should be sadder about this.
Yeah. So I guess I also don't really know, because like Strauss does have a point, like being the face of the atomic bomb and then a decade later, being the face of the opposition to it. It isn't a bad marketing strategy to keep yourself in the headlines if you want to look at it cynically, which Strauss does. But, you know, it works.
All of that is a fair criticism of Oppenheimer, but it has nothing to do with Strauss. Like,
he
used that for his own personal, like, he's also being disingenuous. Like, the fact that he has a valid point is irrelevant because he didn't use it in a good way. He used it for a smear campaign that had nothing to do with what his actual point was.
Yeah.
Like, nobody thought he was actually a Russian plant. Like, nobody thought he deserved to have his security clearance. He just wanted to shut him up, and he couldn't think of a good way to do it, so he went about it in, like, the most unethical manner possible.
Yeah.
He's using McCarthyism, which was a horrible time in America. Like, so many people lost their jobs and livelihoods just for, like, I mean, I really like the line with Matt Damon where he's like, suspected socialist means, like, I'm a New Deal Democrat. He goes, I said suspected. And it's like, you went from being able to just be like, I think we should do things for the population, to like, you're a fucking commie and you can't have a job anymore and you can go work on the goddamn railroad. Like,
right. Yeah.
Not good.
No. Yeah. But like you said, that didn't necessarily matter to Strauss. He's like, well, here's a tool that I can leverage.
And, like, what did he end up doing? He ended up he made him a martyr. He went through this whole thing where he's like, no, I have to do it in secret and be a shady fuck so he doesn't become a martyr. And then he just became a martyr anyway.
Yeah. So the movie, do you think it has, like, a final take on whether or not Oppenheimer was genuinely remorseful? Or maybe that part doesn't even super matter. I don't feel like the movie necessarily lets him off the hook. I think, like, some of the criticism is like, oh, Chris Nolan thinks it's, like, cool and good to make big bombs. And I don't get that at all. It definitely seems like it's very much implicating Oppenheimer as complicit in all of the bad shit that's ever happened in the last 60, 70 years.
That's like, I don't think it really matters either. And I think if you ask Japan, they'd say it doesn't matter either.
Yeah.
I think that, like, the bigger implication is just, like, any scientist would have done this, and they all would have had similar justifications. Like, you could have implicated anyone on the project. You're picking Oppenheimer. Like, I guess he had more to say, but not really. Like, that was going to happen with or without him. And then you really do have to weigh the alternative of like, did you want the Nazis to figure it out first? Like, would that have been better?
Right.
So instead, it's like a European city, most likely, or an American city. I don't know. Like, would they have stopped? Like, America using it stopped colonialism in Japan and expansion in Japan. If the Axis had gotten it, it would have pushed further with more takeover and more. You know what I mean?
Mm.
So,
yeah. Yeah, when we get into the actual historical facts, I'm out of my depth, but I liked this movie. And yeah. I don't really feel like it lets him off the hook either for responsibility, but also for like kind of self-aggrandizement.
For sure. No, I feel like it keeps him very much in check of like, this was just any number of egotistical assholes that wanted power. And they didn't really care what the ultimate end of it was. The fact that it happened to have played out well is kind of irrelevant because there was a number of scientists in Nazi Germany doing the same exact thing.
Yeah. But
I think the larger implication is that like society was wrong.
Yeah. And I do like the part where he's like, what's going to doom the Nazis is anti-Semitism, because they're not going to give the Jewish scientists what they need to actually do this.
Proper funding. I mean, Heisenberg was an amazing scientist. We still, like, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is still a very relevant theory today. Like, it's very interesting to see him in that context. I've heard him referenced in like, you know, quantum physics and stuff like that. And it's like, oh yeah, this man was working for the Nazis, but like that's not remembered as much as Oppenheimer building the bomb that, you know, killed the Japanese is. So it's like, well, what did Heisenberg, you know, did he, we watched, you know, Zone of Interest and there was somebody designing furnaces. Like, what did Heisenberg design even in his limited capacity over there? Like, what was his role over in Germany?
Right. Yeah,
not
fair
sure.
Enough. Not sure. So the movie is really structured around flashbacks stemming from those two different non-trials that are both set up as trials. And in both cases, the characters in them comment that like, oh, this feels like a trial. And then someone's like, this isn't a trial, as a way to like push through some kind of loophole to, you know, really fuck them over. Mm. Except it's funny when it happens to Strauss because we don't like that guy. This to say, what'd you think of when Emily Blunt imagines a naked Florence Pugh on top of Cillian Murphy in that non-courtroom?
That was pretty hot. No, I thought it was it was interesting. I think it was really like, I don't know what the word for it is, like, superimposed or whatever with the scene of like Oppenheimer complete or Cillian Murphy completely naked in the room.
Right.
I really like the those two scenes together. Like she was watching him do that and like he was feeling naked himself. Interesting.
Yeah. I don't see how that was relevant to his security clearance. That lady's dead. She can't take his secrets anymore.
No. So I got a question for you. Do you think she really killed herself or do you think she was murdered?
I think the movie wants you to not be sure, right? Which I think is a cool move for a biopic to have a very subjective depiction of a major character's death where you see her really intentionally setting up that bathtub to drown herself. But then you also, I think it's like, I don't know how many frames you see a gloved hand holding her head underwater for, but it's, I feel like less than a full second. And that's a cool moment.
there's the mention of the two different drugs in her system too. Like one of which she like didn't take or something like that, but they really like, she also suffered from depression. So who knows?
Yeah.
I think even just based on the context of the movie, she was 100% killed. It was like they were following Oppenheimer. They watched him go talk to a known communist, and then they just immediately killed her because they were like, there's no way we can know what he told her. So just to be safe, we're going to have to murder her now.
That certainly feels like what the movie would argue if it did have to pick a side. It feels like it wants you to pick that side.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly in historical context, but I mean, I would not be surprised either way, and I think that's probably also the point of the movie.
Yeah, for sure. Were you like, after so many different famous people had shown up for just like a scene or two, or just to do like a fun Harry Truman impression? Were you surprised to see Rami Malek come back with like some fire right at the end there?
What did he do right at the end? I probably got celebrity fatigue.
Yeah. So he was the guy who testifies that like kind of starts the montage of different scientists testifying against straws, but he's the first one to get into the Senate hearing and be like, actually, this guy sucks.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of expected there to be some kind of turnaround.
Yeah.
Because, like, I mean, you know Oppenheimer isn't known as, like, a suspected communist or whatever. It is interesting, though, because this story particularly, like, the losing his security clearance and all that, I had no idea, any of that happened. So it was definitely interesting. It was cool to see.
Makes sense. I'm going to just embrace the disjointed nature of a Chris Nolan episode and just skip around entirely. Mentioned before, I'm a big Nolan fan, but what's your favorite Nolan movies? Or I guess I should generally ask, like, do you like his movies at first? I feel like I can't remember. I know you had a strong opinion on Inception, right?
No, we came around to, I think I just listened to the podcast this came up on, but like, I was staying away from Nolan movies for a while. Like, I didn't want to watch Inception. Somebody was like, it's a 3-hour movie about like whether or not you know your dreams are real. And I'm like, that sounds fucking terrible. So I stayed away for a while, but I did enjoy it. I don't think I'd ever go watch it again. I do really like Nolan. It's like, what, Dark Knight? Did he do Shutter Island too?
No, that was Scorsese.
Oh, shit. I don't know if I've seen very many then. I think I did. So Inception, this, and I'm drawing a blank on other big ones he's done.
Interstellar.
Oh, yep. I like that one. That one I would go back and rewatch. I feel like I'm more intelligent now and I could actually appreciate it a little bit more than when I first watched it.
Yeah. The Prestige, which I love.
Prestige was really good. That's another one I haven't watched since like high school.
Yeah. He's got those three Batman movies.
Wait, didn't I say The Dark Knight?
Yeah, you said
Shutter Island. That's the one I got wrong. Never mind. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. But Dark Knight. So Batman Begins, Dark Knight, Dark Knight Rises. Memento is a big one for him.
Memento's been on my list for a while. I haven't seen that.
His two between Interstellar and Oppenheimer were Dunkirk and then Tenet, right in the teeth of the pandemic.
Nope, neither one of those. I don't generally like war movies that much. They tend to be too gory for me to like really appreciate. But I guess if I was going to watch one, a Nolan one would be good, because I'm assuming his point is less about the gore and more about something deeper.
I loved it. That was Quentin Tarantino's favorite movie of the year that year.
Damn.
That also was Nolan's first Oscar nom for directing. But yeah, so I've seen all of his feature movies aside from Insomnia, which came out in 2002, and everyone says it's bad.
That's also was it nice. Like the Inception prequel?
It came out way before Inception. He made not all of the Batman, but two of the Batman and the Prestige in between, which are all better, I guess. That's also his only movie that he didn't write, so I'm going to assume that's why it's not as required reading for me. But I've seen all his other stuff, and I like him a lot, and I hope he keeps making big movies that randomly make almost $1 billion.
Oh, did Oppenheimer?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I made $960 million.
Did it lose out to Barbie? Did Barbie beat it by a little bit?
Barbie beat it by lots and lots.
Oh, jeez. Yeah. That checks out. It's a broader audience.
Barbie beat it by a whole bunch. Super Mario movie was second or third of the year, I want to say, which also made over $1 billion. Something else I'm forgetting.
Ugh. All right, I'm a little upset that Mario beat Oppenheimer, but I guess that also makes sense. Again, bigger audience.
So it's a over 3 hour long R-rated biopic, and it made almost $1 billion. It's the second highest grossing R-rated film of all time behind Joker, which, despite being like a more mature take on, you know, Joker, is still an IP movie about a very famous Batman villain, as opposed to, again, a fucking a 3+ hour long biopic about an old scientist guy, and it made almost $1 billion. It's crazy.
That's okay. That's fair. In context, it did very well.
So the top four highest grossing R-rated movies of all time: Joker, Oppenheimer, Deadpool 2, and Deadpool. So, like,
Jesus.
You know, Oppenheimer made more than both Deadpool movies. So,
like, that's impressive, because those were also very good movies. I'm not upset.
Yeah, for what it is, it's crazy. It's crazy. So speaking of Joker and Deadpool and superhero movies, is this movie about how Chris Nolan destroyed film and cinema and the movie industry by making people take superhero movies seriously?
Oh, if it is, it's in the same way that Oppenheimer was guilty about creating the bomb.
You think?
Oh, 100%. I mean, you don't, like, if he did that intentionally, then that's a very much like a sad jerk off session. Like, like, oh no, I ruined the movie by making billions and billions of dollars. Like, no. And I mean, he wanted to be the best. So, like, could he have predicted that superhero movies would take off? Like, it doesn't matter, because he would have made it anyway. Like, he wanted to, and he, I'm not going to take that from him. He did do it the best. And like, he's an incredible director, but like, you would have done it anyway. Don't act sad now.
I like that take. Yeah. Suck it up. It happened.
You know, like, you don't get to pretend to be all sad because you did something horrible. You got to deal with the consequences of your actions. Keep making better movies and like, don't be apologetic about it.
He obviously hasn't ever said that that's what this movie is about, but people online and me like to think that it's at least part of that, part of it, because it's funny. But I do think, to an extent, he probably does feel like some guilt about that. He's the guy who talks a lot about like the health of the movie industry and going to movies and, you know, wanting there to be movies that people see. And he got mad at how Universal released his, no, how Warner Brothers, yes, he's worked with Warner Brothers forever, and he got mad at how they released Tenet, and he thought that they did him dirty. So after making his first like 14 movies with them, he switched for Oppenheimer to Universal.
Ouch.
So he's a guy that cares about that. He was one of the loudest critics of HBO Max's, now just Max, but at the time, HBO Max's strategy of taking all their theatrical movies and just putting them directly on Max during the pandemic.
Yeah. I mean, as much as I like that, I don't know.
That's like, this is your fault, Nolan.
Well, I'd feel worse about it if they weren't, like, you know, having the movie industry, the theater industry, in a chokehold, because it's like, how many independent films do we miss out on because of their fucking stupid ass contract agreements where like you have to show so many movies or blah, 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 or like you can't show this, you know, like they're not blameless in this either. Like, they've had a big part to play in the death of movies, and it's the death of more original, smaller studio movies. I'm so shocked A24 has been able to be as successful as they are given the environment, you know?
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough to break through in any kind of meaningful way. But now A24 has more Oscars than, like, I think, like, Disney's gotten in the last 10 years put together, just from fucking Everything Everywhere All at Once last year.
It's so nuts. I mean, how many movies this year? Is like at least three that I've seen, I think, right? Past Lives, Zone of Interest, and I want to say there was another one.
Yeah, it's almost like wallpaper. It just pops up now. So you used to have to do the kind of, like, you know, comic book guy push your glasses up and go, well, actually, thing about A24 that they're just a, they're just a distributor. They don't even produce movies, but that's not true anymore. They produce a ton of movies now, so I'm not even sure which of these is their production, so I can't speak that anymore.
Gotcha.
They do way more producing now than they used to, when they used to just buy movies and put them out.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't realize that. Huh.
Yeah, but that hasn't been the case for a few years. So like I said, I have no idea which ones are and are not now, and that probably suits them well.
Fair.
I think they produced Everything Everywhere. That's why they got to keep all those Oscars themselves.
That makes sense.
I was going to say, what I was like vamping a little bit because I was trying to find the specifics. So his brother, Jonathan Nolan, also pretty prominent. Weirdly, they're brothers, but they have different accents. Jonathan Nolan doesn't have any British accent. Chris Nolan does. Whatever. Jonathan Nolan, one of the main showrunners of Westworld, which comes up a weird amount on this podcast. And I think Chris Nolan is maybe a credited producer on that, or at least it's assumed that he gave some feedback or ideas or something. But anyway, yeah, they work together a lot. So people assume
that's cool.
And they both work with their partners a lot too. Emma Thomas is Chris Nolan's they're actually married. They have been for a long time, and she's produced all of his films since 1997, which is cool.
Oh, wow.
So she's also nominated for Best Picture along with him for this one.
Huh.
Yeah. Good stuff. Just
for sure.
He's a big wife guy. Just like Oppenheimer, hopefully without the hopefully without the bad stuff. As far as cheating on his wife goes.
I would be surprised. I feel like she would use the similar logic to justify it of like, well, he's a great man. Can I expect to have him all to myself?
Yeah. That's probably like a line she said, like, you're not just self-important. You're actually important to the film industry.
I just wish you would stop saying I am become death while we're fucking.
So I'm going to put that in movies. I'm definitely going to put that in the movie. All right, cool. There's so much in this movie packed in. I love all the imagery, all the apparently practical effects of the different stuff overlaying the screen, especially in that first hour, all the raindrop stuff, the spinning, the fires that the raindrops slowly turn into more and more fiery kind of imagery. Apparently they did all that just like in camera. They had like, I don't know. I have the 4K now, and I'll see if this is on in any of the special features, but like I heard something about it, like a fish tank that they used, that they swirled stuff around in, and that's what they made, you know, all the kind of microscopic looking stuff do. The quantum realm.
Oh, that's really cool. I thought they were just literally using like slides from research, but I guess that makes a little more sense. I don't know if research looks that good.
Right. Yeah. That camera ready. I don't know. I have no idea. I haven't watched those special features yet, but my understanding is most of the effects are practical effects. And obviously we haven't even talked about one of my favorite sequences of the year. That Trinity test sequence is really good.
Yes. Very and, cool explosion.
He did make a big explosion out in the desert. He did that. Good job, Chris.
I can't believe they let him use a nuke.
Yeah. Oh, they had some left over at Los Alamos.
yeah, sure, whatever. We got like, what, 10,000 of those fuckers?
We barely touched on, like, and then this happens, which I think is good for this movie, but there's probably a couple sequences we could have called out, that being one of them. The whole Trinity test is really cool. What a movie moment when it goes off, but it's all silent and everyone's just looking with their different goggles or sunscreen or behind their windshields.
I like the display of the explosion. I wonder, like, I'm sure that was probably more practical effects, but like the shockwave that comes after when they all see it, like you almost feel like everyone's like comfortable. And then it's like, oh no, you haven't even been hit by the blast wave yet.
Right. Right. It's cool stuff. And then it's gone. They take it away from him immediately. He gets to go to a meeting where the guy's like, let's take Kyoto off the list. We went there on our honeymoon. It was lovely. And it's like, oh, these guys are evil.
It was disgusting because like the reason given in history for not doing Kyoto is because it's a World Heritage Site. Like it's like the oldest city in Japan and stuff like right. that. And like, I'm much more inclined to believe that it was because some fucking white dude went on his honeymoon there. Like, that seems more accurate.
It really does. It super does. All right. Anything else you want to say about Oppenheimer?
Good movie. I wouldn't be surprised if it made best picture, but I don't know if I would be upset if it doesn't.
There's a lot of movies that I love this year. And like I said, despite my ranking of American Fiction, there's no movies in the best picture race that I disliked fully this year. So yeah, I think it's going to kind of walk away with best picture, but there's other stuff that I have ranked in front of it, but not a lot. I think I'm higher on Oppenheimer than most of our friends. So with that being said, let's do rankings on a scale of 0.5 to 5 on any scale you're choosing. What would you give Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer?
4.5 out of 5 self-important scientists.
So I would go 5 out of 5 non-zero chances that we ignite the atmosphere in the world.
Oh, nice. Oh, man. I wanted to post on like Ask Scientists or whatever, like on the Reddit thing, because I'm really curious. I know back then there definitely wasn't a way to do a controlled explosion and test it. But I'm wondering if now, like if we like, with the theories they were using and the formula they came up with, was there any way, like in this day and age, to like do a contained test where it wouldn't do that? Because even at like a 0.01% chance, that's still insane when you consider the stakes.
Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't have taken that chance personally.
It's really extreme. I really liked Einstein's comment there too, of like, and what if we find out that it could? He's like, well, then you stop working on it and you let the Nazis know what you found. Right. Like, yeah. That's the call.
Yeah. They wouldn't have cared.
No, they would have been like, perfect. So we made this, and it's either our way or everyone dies.
Gross. I don't like those guys. So we came up with a question for this month last week, which was, if you could add any one category to the Oscars, what would it be? Some of the things we said last week, Ray had said best voice acting. I had mentioned stealing a couple from the Indie Spirit Awards, breakthrough performance, so like best young actor, however you want to phrase it, and like best debut feature, so like the best first movie from a director.
I have one right off the top of my head that I would really like to see, but I feel like I know why it's not one. Best comedy, but I feel like that's so subjective, it would just be a shit show every year.
It's also tough because then does that do what best animated did to the animated movies, and it just is like, oh, well, you have your own island over there, we don't have to consider you in any other category ever again.
Well, I mean, do they? Like, how many comedies were there this year? I guess American Fiction, but that's very loosely a comedy.
Judging by Golden Globes, Barbie and Poor Things. Those were both a comedy at Golden Globes.
I did not realize that Poor Things is a comedy. Interesting. All right.
Pretty funny.
I mean, I think there's an interesting argument there. I think it's like, well, if there is its own category, do we get people putting more effort into comedies? And like, I kind of have an ulterior motive here where like, I want to see more rom-coms. And I feel like if there was a chance at an Oscar, you'd see more of those. But.
I think that's a good point. I wish there were more rom-coms. The ones we did last month for Rom-Com Month Strikes Back, we had Julia Roberts got an Oscar nomination for Pretty Woman, and Cher won an Oscar for Moonstruck, but that obviously just doesn't really happen anymore.
No, not in a while. I was listening to the Tremors episode, and that was the one I want to see more of rom-coms, and I actually gave some thought of like, how would we get more rom-coms? And it's like, well, Oscar potential, that's pretty much the only way.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And just having a generally healthier ecosystem for making stars, because I feel like rom-coms are a good way to make stars, and no one's invested in doing that right now, seemingly, and movies are suffering.
Because all right, like, Ben, we got to be the change we want to see in the world. Let's make for some rom-com.
All right, fine. Twist my arm. I'll star in a $100 million rom-com.
Hell yeah.
One term we haven't used all episode long is Barbenheimer.
Proud of us.
Next week, we are covering Barbie. So
nice.
Also coming later this month is The Ladies. We're going to record it after the Oscars, so we'll already know who won those. But we won't know who won The Ladies until we get in that room and make it happen. You can still vote right now. Maybe you're really mad about how the Oscars went and you want to do some counter voting. You can do that at The Ladies. I'll put a link in. It doesn't seem to work on iTunes, but maybe if you're looking in your app, there's a clickable link in the description of this episode to go vote for The Ladies. It's just a link to a Google form. You can also find that on our Linktree, which is linktr.ee/linktothemovies. And I think that just about does it. Thanks, Robbie, for being here. Any final thoughts? Anything we missed?
No, I think we covered as much as we can for the 3.5-hour movie.
I think so, too. And I am starting to lose my voice. And you got to go watch Poor Things. So do that.
Hell yeah.